This is Arthur David Talbot, T-A-L-B-O-T. My friends call me Dave, and I hope you will. I was born in Winnemucca, Nevada.
Better spell that.
W-I-N-N-E-M-U-C-C-A. Winnemucca is one of the larger towns in the northern desert there. My father was the pastor of the Episcopal Church in Winnemucca. And I was only about 6 months old when we moved to Utah, where he had a mission to the Ute Indians up near the Colorado-Wyoming-Utah line. So I grew up on the Ute Reservation. And I am a Ute Indian by adoption and grace, and had been formally adopted by the tribe. So I had this wonderful childhood. Played cowboys and Indians with real Indians. And my father was very active and interested in governmental affairs. This was right at the time. My boyhood was the young boyhood was the time of the Great Depression, and there were many, many governmental issues which were important to our tribe, including the question of whether or not they could vote. They had never been allowed to vote until my dad stuck his oar in. I graduated from East High School in Salt Lake City and joined the Navy in 1943 when I turned 17. And the Navy finally sent me to officers training school. It was called V-12 at Colgate University and then to Cornell. And after the war, I went back to Cornell and got my A.B. in political science, and then to the Cornell Law School.
Why did you go to law school?
I think it was my dad's interest in law and many, many discussions with him about, he had no legal training, but he was an excellent lawyer nonetheless. I'd been with my dad to he'd take me with him when we'd go call on the governor of the state of Utah and get a few things straightened out with him or with the attorney general. It was a time when Utah was a small state, small community. It was not unlike Alaska when we came up here. Also, I knew a very great lawyer in Salt Lake named Harold Waldo. And my oldest sister married one of his sons, so we were kind of in-laws. But Harold Waldo, to me, as a young boy, was my idea of what a man might be. And when I found out he was a lawyer, I was even more turned in that direction.
Why? What were his attributes that you admired?
This tremendous calm and competence and love and the greatest family life, the greatest family man I ever knew, and a great father of his children. And one time it was my brother had to be made my guardian for a year because I was living with him my last year in high school. Mr. Waldo was the attorney who arranged that. So I got to go with him over to the courthouse in Salt Lake, and I saw how he behaved and how people behaved toward him. And I just fell in love with the whole process.
Mm-hmm. What kind of law did Mr. Waldo practice?
He was a corporation lawyer, and was the president of a public utility, the Telluride Corporation. Telluride. Telluride Corporation, there's a town called Telluride in Colorado, one of the old silver mining towns. Mm-hmm. And the Telluride Corporation had mining interests and public utility holdings. And incidentally, they, at Cornell, it turns out just by coincidence, there is an institution called Telluride House, which is a men's dormitory built to, right near the law school, built to house scholars that are sponsored, students that are sponsored by the Telluride Corporation.
When you graduated from law school, where did you go?
I went to, I took the New York bar in the summer of 1950 and miraculously passed because I hadn't prepared for it in any way. Didn't expect to pass it. In fact, I think I asked for my money back. I think it was a $25 fee, they told me it was not refundable. So I said, well, I know some people in Albany, so I'll go over there and see George and Millie and take your old exam. And so they passed me. And then I went down to the General Theological Seminary of the Episcopal Church in New York, and Chelsea Square, which was my dad's seminary, and enrolled there. And but I left after one semester and decided I would look for a law job in New York.
Why did you decide not to pursue that?
I felt that the other students, or the atmosphere among the students of the seminary at that time, that there were a bunch of wise guys. They weren't looking for God the way I was looking for God. I didn't feel. Mm-hmm. And just whatever I was looking for wasn't there for me, not at that time.
When you graduated from law school, did you think you weren't going to practice?
Yes, that's right. I was undecided.
Mm-hmm. So the experience in the seminary school made you decide to practice?
Yes. The more time I spent in seminary, the more I wanted to practice law. Seminary's changed a lot since those days. They're a lot closer now to the Bible and to the work of the Holy Spirit and to the Lord.
Yeah. When you went into practice, were you in New York?
Yes. I made a list of, I think I used a telephone book, I know I did, because I didn't know about Martindale and Hubbell, but I made a list of the 20 or 30 top law firms in the United States. And I took the subway down to Old Trinity and started down the left-hand side of Wall Street, and I just worked it up one side and down the other until I got a job. It turned out the job was around the corner on Broad Street, down from the Stock Exchange, a couple, 80 Broad, with an admiralty firm.
What was the practice like?
It was beautiful. This firm, I do believe that it was then that there was no finer law firm in the world. Mm-hmm. There were two of the partners had written the standard American works in their field. Griffin on collisions at sea, and Poor on charter parties and ocean bills of lading. Well, you had two senior partners like that, and it was still a relatively small firm. There were only 13 partners. And we did nothing but litigation, admiralty and aviation, but I was in the admiralty part. We had about four clients that accounted for about 60% of our business. We had about 4,000 lawsuits pending at any one time. And New York, of course, is the center, still is the center of admiralty litigation for the whole world, mm-hmm. and has jurisdiction, you know, over the whole globe. So we fought out all kinds of cases there that arose anywhere in the world.
When you were looking for your first job, did you know what kind of law you wanted to practice?
No, I didn't. But I remembered Professor McDonald's advice. Some kid asked him one day how we should determine what kind of lawyers we were going to be. And McDonald shouted at him, "That's easy." He said, "You will practice the kind of law that is practiced by the guy who hires you when you get your first job." So, and I was absolutely dumbstruck when I found out this was an admiralty firm. I'd been interviewed by 12 of the 13 partners before I found out they were an admiralty firm. And but I knew they were, you know, a great firm, but I did not know it. And it was so funny too, because we had at Cornell Professor Gustav Robinson, who had written the Horn book on admiralty, and a great admiralty, and he was from New York too. He'd worked in Burlingame's office down there, and just, you know, internationally known figure in admiralty. Well, the last partner that I interviewed, Wharton Poor, a crusty, wonderful man, and he said, "I see you come to us from Cornell, Mr. Talbot." I said, "Yes." Said, "I suppose you took Professor Robinson's course in admiralty." And I said, "No, Mr. Poor, I missed it. It's only given in alternate years, and I could not work it in." And Poor said, "Good." Then he went on to say, he said, "You know, this firm has been practicing in this neighborhood within 3 or 4 blocks of where we are. We've been practicing admiralty law for about 115 years now. We're not too good at it, but we're rather set in our ways. And sometimes we get these young men who have had a course in admiralty, and it's quite a while before they come around to our way of thinking."
Mm-hmm. How long did you spend with the firm?
Let's see. 1951 and 52 until November.
Why did you leave?
Awfully hot in Manhattan and Brooklyn in the summer of 52, and had a classmate, Burton Biss, who was clerking for Judge Folta in Juneau, mm-hmm. wrote one of the professors at Cornell saying that, this was Ernie Warren, saying that there was a vacancy in the U.S. Attorney's office in Anchorage.
What professor did he write?
Ernest Warren. And Marie and I had 2 weeks vacation that year, which we spent up at Moosehead Lake up in Maine. Mm-hmm. On our way back, we stopped through Ithaca, and I went up to my law school and saw Ernie Warren, and just by coincidence, he showed me this letter from Bert Biss, and I told him that I wouldn't have Alaska as a gift. I was all set with this Broad Street law firm and was going to spend the rest of my life there. But that night it was very hot in my mother's apartment, even up there in Ithaca. Mm-hmm. And so about 1 o'clock in the morning, I said, "Shall we?" And she said, "Sure." So we we came to Alaska. I think I telephoned a U.S. attorney who was Seaburn Buckaloo, Jr. And he said, "Come on up," was all he said.
So Bert Fiss said there was an opening where?
In the U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage.
In Anchorage.
Judge Folta had been holding court up here, and Buck and Bert had been sheep hunting, I think, with the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And so on, Bert was corresponding with Professor Warren.
You just mentioned it.
Just mentioned it.
Was Bert Fiss Folta's clerk?
Yes.
He was. Did Folta recruit from Cornell?
Yes, he did. There was a, in 1949, there was a fellow named Krasilowski, whom I never met.
Spelling?
No, I can't, but it's a Polish name, and it's Krasilowski. But he was class of 49, and he came to Juneau, introduced himself to Judge Folta and said, I'm your law clerk, your new law clerk. And Judge Folta said, well, I've never had a law clerk. I don't know whether it would do me any good to have one. And I don't know whether I'm entitled to one, but I'll find out. So the judge found out he was, and he hired Krasilowski, and Krasilowski did a good job. So at the end of the year, the Judge Folta, who had never been to law school himself, praise God, a fine lawyer and a fine judge, but he phoned the dean, Robert Stevens, and who did the Horn book on corporations, and said, Krasilowski was neat, send me another one. So, on sight and unseen. And so, the dean sent Ed Mertes. And so Mertes clerked for Folta. And then the phone call went in again, and Bert Biss was dispatched.
So Folta never talked to his clerks before?
Never talked to his clerks, relied entirely on Dean Stevens to send him somebody worthwhile, and the dean really did when he sent him Ed Mertes and Bert Biss. Yeah.
When you went up, though, you went up with the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Right.
That's totally different practice than what you were doing in New York.
Well, actually, the U.S. Attorney does have some admiralty work.
Mm-hmm.
I see they just settled a case with some Japanese fishermen for almost $1 million. And I did a little maritime work in the U.S. Attorney's office. But yes, it was quite a switch.
What was the atmosphere in Alaska when you came? What was it like?
Oh, it was beautiful. It was so, friendliness of the people. Within a week, Marie and I knew that we had found home and that we would never leave this place. And I remember breakfast the first morning, a little diner, which is right where on 4th Avenue where the National Bank of Alaska is now. But the fellow that cooked our hotcakes, and I know everybody called him Partner. His name was Strunk, and he now has a store up in Glen Allen. I think he's still alive. But he just welcomed us with open arms, and we met a fellow named Mike Baker, who is still around. But everyone that you met became your friend automatically. And
but how many people were here?
I would guess maybe 15,000.
Mm-hmm. Did Buckaloo hire you sight unseen?
Yes.
So it was confirmed that you were hired over the telephone.
Yes, I think he sent me a wire. Mm-hmm. It was funny. I phoned him, and I didn't get to him. I got to Gladys, the secretary. But I said, now, you know, Buck's offered me the job, and I've accepted it, or Mr. Buckaloo has. How do I get to Alaska? And how do I get appointed, you know, by the U.S. Attorney General and all that?
Mm-hmm.
And Gladys said, we don't know. She said, Buck's only acting U.S. Attorney. And we've never done this before. So, and you're closer to Washington than we are. So why don't you work on it from your end? So I phoned the Department of Justice in Washington, and they came to my assistance, and within a day or two, there were FBI people in the office talking to Mr. Poore about whether I was any good and whether I was loyal to the United States. That was a big thing in those days. And the McCarthy thing was underway. But of course when we finally got up here, we had about $30 left, and we'd driven up over the highway, and we got in town about 4 o'clock. It was November afternoon. It was dark already, so I went right down to the courthouse and reported to Mr. Buckaloo, who said, Talbot, he said, gee whiz, I was surprised you came up here seeing how the election turned out. And what had happened was, while we were driving up here, Eisenhower beat Stevenson. And here was Buckaloo, who was a Democratic appointment, and he didn't expect to be in office more than a few weeks. He thought he'd be immediately replaced. And he didn't really know whether there was a job for me. I mean, after, you know, on the way the election had turned out. Also, I had to be cleared by the Democratic Central Committee. I remember that. But he had never asked me if I was a Democrat. But anyway. But Buck went on. We served together for about a year. They were very slow in replacing him. And
did you serve only under the Democratic
Committee? No. The next U.S. attorney was Bill William Plummer, mm-hmm. the brother of the United States District Judge. And Bill Plummer and I got along fine, and I guess I could still be working there as far as he and I were concerned.
So it wasn't so much party allegiance?
No, except that as today, the U.S. attorney is a political job.
But
the assistants are not.
Yeah. When you were U.S. attorney, what kind of matters did you handle?
Little criminal, very little, enough to get my feet wet, and tort claims cases. One of the biggest, money-wise, certainly the biggest case I had was the first one. It involved a collision between a southbound passenger train of the Alaska Railroad and a northbound work train of Morrison Knutson Company, and they hit head-on down here at Rainbow, which is exactly mile 107 on the Seward Highway. There was a very bad curve there, and what they were doing was they were building the highway for the first time. There had been a railroad to Seward, but no road. Mm-hmm. And so they took the railroad and moved it down toward the water. And then they were converting the original rail bed into a road so that you could actually drive to Seward.
I like what you're doing.
Yeah, they're still working on it, and it's still about in the same place, mile 107. But it was...
What was the name of that kid?
Dushan, yeah, it's reported, and it went to the Ninth Circuit. Dushan, D-U-S-H-O-N, against the United States. I had some very distinguished opponents, George Grigsby, mm-hmm. Bailey Bell, and Harold Butcher. Because there were a couple of deaths and some severe injuries.
In a case like this, these people weren't in one firm together, were they?
No.
So were they representing different parties? Or?
Yes, they each had different plaintiffs that they represented, and they pooled their interests.
Were there any big firms when you arrived?
No. The biggest firm in town was Davis and Renfrew, or probably Davis, Renfrew, and Hughes by that time. John Hughes had come over from Kodiak. And, but aside from them, and there were only, I guess, probably four attorneys, so that would be the largest firm in town.
Who else was with them? Davis, Renfrew, Hughes,
and... Dave Thorsness came up by sometime after me. I don't remember just when Dave went to work with them.
Mm-hmm. How many lawyers were in town when you arrived?
My guess would be 20, 25, about 25 probably, including all the government attorneys. Yeah.
But most of them were solo practitioners?
Almost everyone.
Did they have good practices? Were they making money?
Yes, but the big problem was the backlog in the court.
Mm-hmm.
The town had, we only had one judge and far too much litigation for him to handle.
Was this Judge Diamond?
This was Judge Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually didn't get a second judge until statehood. So that was the big problem of practicing law here, but we made a living.
What were most of the cases? What kind of cases?
Oh, the whole gamut.
Was it everything?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I had I'd grown very fond of litigation from my brief experience in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about all I've ever done. That's all I did.
Did lawyers specialize at all? Did you know which lawyer to go to for certain things?
Not really. Not in those days. I don't think anybody did.
Not even word of mouth?
Yes. It was well known that John Manders and I knew a little admiralty, and that Ed Davis would form you a good corporation, and that Wendell Kay would do a good job if you were accused of a crime, and... But it was entirely word of mouth.
Are there any other people that you can think of, word of mouth, that you would go to for certain things?
Well, Grigsby, Kay, and McCutcheon for criminal work, and Renfrew and Davis for civil work.
From the U.S. Attorney's Office, people who came out of it, did people ever think that they had influence with the office?
No. The ethics of our bar were tremendously high.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a little while to realize that. I think my youth and inexperience. But...
Why do you say it took you a while to realize that?
Well, I became involved in a series of quasi-disciplinary cases in which I always seemed to take the wrong side or take too serious a view of what had happened.
Can you explain why too serious a view?
Well, for example, there was some complaint against John Shaw, who I think is still practicing in Palmer. And this arose out of the Duchon case. The fact that John, would be, the accident occurred while John was a law student, but also a dispatcher for the railroad. And... his name appeared on some of the pleadings in the Duchon case. And I don't know, I may have filed a complaint against John, a misdemeanor charge, probably a federal conflict of interest. I wouldn't do that again. I'm satisfied now and have been for many years, that Harold Butcher simply put John's name on the pleadings as a compliment, as a courtesy. Mm-hmm. And that nothing John said or did that was any way adverse to the United States or to the government's position in that case, nor is he capable of it. Mm-hmm. Just if you know John Shaw, you know that he didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah. So are you saying that the personal standards of the people up here were fairly high? Appearance may have been...
Yeah, the appearance was very informal, but when you got underneath that,
mm-hmm.
These were tremendous people, these lawyers.
What about someone like George Grigsby?
George was a great lawyer and a great man.
I've heard of some fairly unethical things that he's done.
Can you recount any? Because I've never.
In the very early years, for instance, in Ketchikan, it said that he tampered with evidence.
Never, absolutely. George wouldn't be capable of that.
Uh-huh.
And now it is true, as you know, that the grand jury returned a minority presentment against him up at Nome as an accomplice to murder. But that was phony too.
Isn't it about 1903?
Yes.
Like, what happened in that case?
I really don't know, except that George used to. He could quote this. They would have indicted him, this minority faction on the grand jury, you see, that was playing along with Judge Moore.
Mm-hmm.
They would have indicted George, but the majority of the grand jury, or at least a good percentage of them, knew that George was incapable of wrongdoing. So they did a presentment, and George used to be able to recite it from memory, and it was hilarious. It was drawn by laymen, but I remember the phrase, "these bleak and barren shores," and it was, you know, a lot of the pleadings were quite poetic in those days.
Are they available anywhere? Is it written somewhere or recorded?
Harold Butcher would know, Judge Butcher. He's in town. I saw him the other day,
mm-hmm.
on the street. He was very close to George.
What about the Stringer case?
The Stringer case was an ethical problem. I think what Harold did in that case was not proper. He charged a man a fee in a criminal case without ever appearing for him or doing any work for him. All Harold did was discover that the United States attorney was going to dismiss the case.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Mann Act case, a local cab driver.
Mm-hmm.
And months after the case was dismissed, to be more accurate about it, Harold came over to the Merrimack. And I don't remember whether I was there or whether I've just thought about it so many times that I imagine I was there. But I know that Buck and Lynn Kirkland and Harold and I and other attorneys used to walk across the street to the Merrimack frequently after work. But anyway, Harold came by one day, said that a fellow named Kemp had consulted him, that he was thinking about taking the case, but Stringer was undecided about whether he would take the case. And I think it was Lynn Kirkland or Buck, one or the other, said, "There's nothing to that case, Harold. We're dismissing it." And then the conversation went on to something else. And then months later, Kemp came in and talked to one of the girls in the office and wanted to know if he had to continue making payments on this installment promissory note. to Stringer and Connolly. And that's how the thing came to light.
Was Stringer partnered with Connolly then?
Yeah.
Why wasn't Connolly brought in if he was laying on the note?
Well, because it was Harold's, quote, case, end quote.
So he got out of it.
Yeah. But, and I don't know how much, if anything, John knew about it. We all learned a lot about it afterwards, but at the time, I don't know. And
how did he get out of it? By just saying it was Harold's case?
Well, yes, right. Harold had done everything that had been done. I mean, he's the one that came over with the Merrimack and found out the case was not going to be prosecuted. So it never went to the grand jury. Camp had been arrested on a complaint and had made bail. And then the complaint was dismissed, and that was it. But Mr. Stringer never made an appearance for the fella, and probably spent some time in the office talking with him. There were some conferences, I'd never thought of that, really, how much time Harold might have had involved in the case.
How much was he charging him?
The figure of $1,300 comes to mind, which would have been a lot of money in those days. I think that the size of the note and the fact that the guy was paying month after month for for very little. But I handled it badly.
What?
And so did Kirkland. Well, I wasn't going to take Kemp's word for anything. So I used the U.S. Attorney's favorite tool. I ran the whole thing before the grand jury. And that way we could get Kemp under oath and, you know, get the evidence and so forth. And after doing that, I was satisfied that a complaint should be made, a disciplinary complaint against Mr. Stringer. I think really it could have been handled informally.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe would be today, I don't know.
Under this territorial system, who made the disciplinary complaint and who did it go to? What was the procedure?
There was no bar association, mm-hmm. except the Anchorage Bar, which was an informal thing. And so the United States Attorney would file an information with the court, the U.S. District Court for mm-hmm. for the territory, and that would be... That was the way discipline was administered.
Who filed the information in this case? In the Stringer case?
I know I prepared it. I forget whether I signed it or Buck signed it. I probably signed it as an assistant U.S. attorney, but I'm not sure.
There's been a lot of controversy about the Stringer case. It's one of the cases that you always hear about, and you hear about it in relation to Judge McCary.
Yes.
Why?
Well, because Harold took credit for Judge McCary's appointment,
mm-hmm.
and I think he was entitled to credit for it, too.
mm-hmm.
And a lot of the lawyers felt that Judge McCary was really not too well suited for the job. He was and is a man of absolute honesty and integrity. There was never any question of that. But I think he probably in those days was a little deficient in legal knowledge and in judicial temperament,
mm-hmm.
and so everybody was holding Harold responsible for that appointment. And but it was sort of common knowledge that Harold had been responsible for Mac's appointment. So when the time went by, and Judge Diamond died, and Judge McCary was appointed, and so this case, the Stringer case, came on before Judge McCary for hearing, mm-hmm. and Judge McCary said that he was disqualified because of his political and other, his friendship and so on with Harold Stringer, and then proceeded to hear the case anyway. And this is the precise grounds upon which the Ninth Circuit reversed the Stringer case, mm-hmm. was that a judge who says he is disqualified and who disqualifies himself had better turn the case over to another judge. This is sort of typical of some rather elementary mistakes that Judge McCary was making in those days.
Why did he hear it after he said that he disqualified himself?
No idea. It may have been, I cannot imagine. Mm-hmm. No. Maybe he thought that unless the parties did something, said, yeah, one of the parties said, yes, we think you are disqualified, Judge, why? That was necessary or something. He had some mistaken notion of the law. I don't think that Mac wanted the case. I think he'd have been happy to have somebody else handle it. Mm-hmm. And my life certainly would have been simpler if he'd have done that.
Why?
If we'd had another. Because I got in a frightful jam with him. Yeah, because the Stringer case, the trial was going on, and I was staying away from it. I got to strike something earlier. I said that I could have been over at the Merrimack, you know, on that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. I was in New York City and had never heard of Alaska. Was just a spot on the map.
Right.
When this all happened, yeah. What I'm thinking about is other conversations that, you know, Harold would come over after I got up here and you know. But this was just kind of, he was just one of the guys that we hung around the Merrimack with. So I stayed clear away from the Stringer trial because everything that had happened in that case had happened before I came to Alaska. And I was just practicing law when I got a subpoena as a witness for the defense, I guess. And so I went over and was sworn, and Wendell Kay asked me one question. He said, did you or not threatened to indict Seaborn Buckaloo unless he filed this information against Harold Stringer? And I said, certainly not. And that night, Cliff Groh told me that I had threatened Buck and that Cliff was a witness.
Was Cliff Groh in the U.S. Attorney's Office at the time?
No, but he and Buck were studying for the bar. Mm-hmm. I remember Marie and I went to a movie at the 4th Avenue while the Stringer case was, well, the draft of the information was on Buck's desk and had been for some time, that's what it was, and the grand jury was very hot. When the evidence they'd heard, they wanted to indict Harold for larceny by false pretenses. And I refused. They sent a committee to Judge Fulton and said that I was covering up for Harold.
Uh-huh. It Why was, Judge Fulton?
Well, Judge, I don't know whether Judge Diamond had died. Yes, I believe he had. Mm-hmm. And sure, he died before he signed the judgment in the Dushan case. Mm-hmm. So Judge Folda was up here helping out. And the grand jury got so angry at Harold for charging Kemp a fee for in a case in which he never made an appearance, mm-hmm. that they instructed me to draw an indictment for larceny by false pretenses, and I refused to do it. They sent a committee of the grand jury to the judge and said I was dishonestly trying to cover up for Harold Stringer, and they knew what was going to happen. As soon as the grand jury adjourned, the case would be forgotten, because mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I had talked it over with Buck, and he had agreed with me that, yes, we would file an information. And so I drafted the information, and I'm quite sure probably read it to the grand jury, pacify them.
Right.
And then went on to Buck, and all Buck had to do was approve it and be, but, you know, filed. I think it was probably typed in final form by that time. But it just sat on his desk. And so this particular night, Marie and I were going to the movie. I said, wait right here in the lobby of the 4th Avenue, and I went across the street. And sure enough, Buck and Cliff were in the office studying for reviewing for the bar. Which irritated me a little bit because I had to take the bar too, but I didn't get to take any time. Well, this was at night. They were on their own time that time. I do remember that Buck and Kirk, I thought, spent more time studying for the bar than they should.